Support for this public radio podcast comes from Pabst Brewing, supporting live music and local artists nationwide, and proud supporter of NPR Music Podcasts at PabstBlueRibbon.com.
Hey there, this is In the Loop. I'm Jeff Horwich. Now, before we get started, our audience here at Minnesota Public Radio and the UBS Forum has a couple of decisions to make. First of all, audience, what kind of music would you like as we proceed into the show? A couple options. New Age. By show of applause. Anybody want New Age? Hey. Not a lot of New Age fans. Okay, the next one, we got hip-hop. Hip-hop. Okay, pretty good. Option number three, polka. All right, looks like polka. Somehow I think I saw that coming. Okay, choice number two. What kind of a voice should I use for the rest of the show tonight? A couple of choices for you. We've got Leprechaun as one voice we could try. Not bad.
All right, Surfer Dude is an option for you.
And then we got something we're calling Good Old Boy. Would you like Good Old Boy to take you into the rest of the program?
Well, I actually think Surfer Dude won out. So Surfer Dude it is as we move into In the Loop. Finally, who would you like to be the co-host for the show tonight? Your choices, Garrison Keillor. All right, Garrison, give us a big sniff into your microphone so we know you're there. There he is. Okay, Ira Glass is a possibility.
Hi, Jeff.
All right, Ira, not a bad showing.
Hi, Jeff. From WBZ in Chicago, it's Ira Glass.
All right, thanks for being here. Or choice number three is Elmo. That's a tight one. Ira, I'm sorry. I'm going to have to hand it to Elmo. I think he took
you
to school
life,
on this one. Well, you're listening to In the Loop from Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Jeff Horwich. With me tonight as a co-host, as it turns out, is Elmo. And Elmo is...
Hi! Elmo, sorry to keep you waiting.
That's all right, dude.
Elmo was just using the toilet.
Well, that's fine. That's great, dude. But we're all proud of you. We have a show to do here.
Yeah!
Okay, good. You have any ideas for us? Like, we got like an hour to fill, so...
Elmo can talk to a shoe!
A shoe? Okay. Not exactly the kind of interview we're going for here.
Elmo helps set the table sometimes at his house.
That's... Okay. All right, tonight's show is about democracy, and I think right now, dudes, we're discovering that maybe democracy is not the best way to do certain things. Like maybe start a radio show. That's why I gotta step in. I'm sorry, this is totally against coolness, but I gotta drag us back into autocracy, authoritarianism. Ready, dudes? In 3, 2, 1. Oh, that's better.
All right, far more comfortable. Democracy is what we're talking about tonight on In the Loop. And, you know, that word sure gets a lot of lip service these days.
How healthy is democracy?
No democracy can survive.
Democracy.
From the birth of our democracy.
The political framework of the capitalist thought.
A democracy.
Our democracy.
Democracy not for sale.
The only path to true progress is the path of freedom and justice and democracy.
Now, President Bush is not afraid to use the word democracy. He uses it a lot. And when he uses it, I think when most of us use it, for whatever reason, it stands for more than the dictionary definition. Government by the people is basically that definition. Very simple, pretty vague, not at all inspiring unless you plop it into something like the Gettysburg Address. Then it kind of pops. We Americans love the term for all the grander things it implies. Openness, equality, respect, enlightenment, engagement. Democracy is a calling for us. We think of democracy like it's at the core of who we are. I'd admit to that, I think I do. At the core of what it means to be human. But if democracy is such a big part of our essence, if it's such an awesome thing, you'd think we'd all see it all over the place, right? From our personal relationships, to our education, to the places where we work. Today's In the Loop is about democracy as a way of life. Is it inherently in us? Are we living it, practicing what we preach? Or are we blinded by the glow of that word and all that it stands for? Now, look, I'd be lying if I said this was a simple topic we chose for ourselves tonight. In fact, picking this episode's theme was not exactly a democratic process within our own staff. I think if we'd been more true to the ideals of democracy, we might not actually have a democracy show for you at all. and we might have a little bit more Elmo. Who knows? But our house band, the Smarts, and our audience here at Minnesota Public Radio are certainly up to the task, I believe, and I think we've got a terrific hour ahead. Whether you're joining us by podcast, radio, or here in person, thanks for casting your vote to join us in the loop. All right, let's not beat around the George W. Bush here. Our mission tonight is to ponder whether this democracy idea we love so much is really all it's cracked up to be. And when you want to wrap your head around a really big issue like this, nobody can boil it down better than your local high school debate team. Please welcome, if you would, our participants in the In the Loop Great Democracy Debate, Dan Willey and Amelia Spaulding. Amelia and Dan are both seniors at Robbinsdale Cooper High School. They're some of the finest debaters in all of Minnesota, I'm not lying, in a debate style known as Lincoln Douglas, which we are going to thoroughly bastardize here tonight. The statement we have given you both for tonight's In the Loop debate is, democracy is the best way for groups of people to make decisions. We flipped a coin before the show, and Dan, you'll be taking the position, more or less, you know, democracy, awesome. And Amelia, you'll be taking the position, democracy, sucks. We will begin, Dan, with your opening statement.
All right. To begin, what is democracy? Democracy arises from the notion that in some respect, we're all equal. We may come from different cultures, religions, and upbringings, but in reality, we're more in common than we believe. Democracy carries with it many benefits other than just justice and morality, the ability for every individual to speak openly. Democracy directly stops dictatorships that can seek to oppress us. It serves as a check from one individual gathering too much power over another. Furthermore, you can envision democracy as a sort of marketplace of ideas where people can come together, share their views. And obviously, the more views present, the more likely we are to find the views that are the best or the most correct. For these reasons, I truly believe that democracy is the best.
All right. Debate team or high school football game, we can't tell the difference, but it's more fun this way. Now, an opening statement. On the contrary, democracy, not so hot. Amelia, take it away.
Thomas Jefferson once said, "A democracy is nothing more than mob rule, where 51% of the people may take away the rights of the other 49. I believe that this is completely true. Democracy as a concept is a good thing, but it's not truly applicable in society. There are too many different ideas in the world, too many different religions, cultures, and ways of life. Look to countries like Iraq, where you have such differences in religion, such differences in how people believe the way should work, you're never going to be able to come to one majority decision that everyone's going to be happy, which leads to some sort of tyranny of the majority, which is a bad thing. And also, you have to look at democracy on a smaller scale. Look at the idea of a democracy in a school or home. You wouldn't want everybody in a school to have a majority rule because the students would be in charge of the teachers. Look at the idea of a democracy in a home. If all the children suddenly had rule over their parents, we would never grow up the way that we're meant to, because children don't know what's right for them. You have to have some sort of authority figure to ever learn anything the right way. If I was to go home tonight and my parents were to tell me to do something and I could get, you know, me and four of my brothers to say, nope, that's not gonna happen, then, you know, hey, that's what's gonna happen if you actually had true democracy everywhere. If you want kids to just decide they're gonna eat a chocolate bar for dinner every single night, their parents wouldn't have any say. And parents know what's best for their children. That's why they're in place. So that's why you can't look at democracy on every single scale. It's not a good thing.
Yes, and applause are perfectly acceptable. All of you hate democracy, it's good to know. Okay, now a little bit different format for the next section of our debate. We're gonna go for 3 or 4 minutes here. This is called a cross-examination. Amelia, a question for Dan, if you would.
All right, so you try and say that everybody's equal in democracy and that there's, you know, a bigger marketplace of ideas, but what do you say about those people whose ideas aren't heard?
Well, I would say if there's people's ideas who aren't heard in a democracy, then it wouldn't truly be a democracy.
Okay,
worthy of a fanfare, evidently. All right, we've got a few minutes left, you two, so go at it. Amelia.
OK, okay, but like, aren't there times when, you know, maybe everyone's ideas need to be heard, but not necessarily like put into action? Like, I gave you examples of like schools and things like that. Like, would you agree that all the students should run a school?
Well, I mean, I would argue that if it weren't for democracy, we wouldn't even have a school system. I mean, certainly the school system is predicated on the same belief that all people are equal if given equal opportunities.
Okay, but, like, then who do you think should have this idea? I mean, do you want, like, all of our classmates in school to be deciding all of the stuff that's happening in the country? What is your stance on that?
It should be everybody.
So, like, you want, like, the 4-year-olds to be voting for who's president of the United States?
Well, sure. They have equal opportunity to make decisions. They have to live in the same world as everybody else.
Okay, but then what about you get the people who just think, oh, this president looks better, or I like this president's voice? Like, that's not a good thing. Isn't that going to lead to some sort of bad decisions?
But see, if we had more democracy, their education would be better, and that wouldn't be an issue.
By the time they're 4? I mean, how are you going to say that everybody should have a vote, and you're going to have a 5-year-old who doesn't know how to walk is going to go take a colored marker and just scribble on a piece of paper? Like, how is that logical?
Well, the colored marker might work better than Chad's, actually, but... It's a very interesting idea. But yeah, I think that that's fair. I mean, the 4-year-old, for example, the policies that we initiate today, they'll be paying for in their future. So I think that they're going to be affected by it just as much, if not more, than everybody else. They should have a say in how it's run.
Okay, but don't you believe that there are some people out there that have more authority and more right to be making these decisions?
That have a God-given right to make decisions?
Well, no, but like they have more authority. They've learned more. They've experienced more life. They know what's supposed to be good and bad for a country. Like, you can't expect a small child or even some teenagers are own age to make decisions for the rest of the world. Like,
well, sure, and that's why there shouldn't be an authoritarian regime, because not any one person has that right to decide for everybody else.
Okay, but shouldn't there be that one person who makes like the general decisions, that makes these general policies that all people have to follow? Because aren't there some things that just everybody follows, some certain principles of like rights in life?
Well, the obvious answer, given that I'm pro, would be no.
Now we need to move along to the close of the debate. And remember, there are no winners or losers on In the Loop Great Democracy Debate. Only people who didn't do quite as well as the other person. If I could have a drum roll, please. Because of our limitations of time, I'm able to allot you each a closing sentence. Dan, your closing sentence.
Because democracy allows everybody to have a voice and provides for the equality of everyone, I strongly believe that democracy is the best system.
And Amelia.
Because we don't want 4-year-olds running our country with markers and colored pencils, we shouldn't use democracy in every aspect of life.
Amelia Spaulding and Dan Willey, everybody, our high school debaters. Thank you very much for joining us on the In the Loop Great Democracy Debate. This is In the Loop on Minnesota Public Radio, and I'm Jeff Horwich. You know, when I think democracy, I think like most people, I have one thought above all others, and that is banjo. Now, people like to say freedom isn't free, and that's true. There's all kinds of costs, you see, and if you want to know if it's worth it, you got to check. Thomas Jefferson thought he had some idea, and sometimes that guy just had logorrhea. But he wrote it, it's famous, and so now what the heck? He said, the price of democracy is eternal vigilance or some such and such, and besides the fact that don't rhyme with much, in the end, just kind of leaves you feeling flat. Now, I don't mean to badmouth old Thomas J. The guy had lots of good things to say, but I think we can still do a whole lot better than that. The last presidential vote in 2004, 120 million, a little bit more, decided they'd go out and cast a vote that day. It takes 30 minutes for the average Joe from a day when he's otherwise making dough. You can bet there'll be a mighty big price to pay. Now, not everyone works, but if you average it out, it turns out our time is worth round about $38,000 a year, or $19 an hour. Now, it takes a sec, but if you do the math, the voters times the wage and divide by half, that's $1.1 billion in lost economic power. That's right, that's the cost of democracy.
Well, them people sure aren't kidding when they say freedom isn't free. It makes you feel good, it probably should, and I probably would agree. But just so you know, there's a cost to democracy. Now, putting aside the cost of our time, just think about all the real nickels and dimes that we all give just to keep the system going. Well, people gotta run, gotta pay for ads and flyers and staffers and legal pads. Elections get bigger and the money just keeps on flowing. Now every year they raise a little bit more, $3.7 billion in 2004. That's 12 bucks from every woman, child, and man. Now we could be spending that on other things like medicine, housing, and playground swings. Feed 10 million people a day over in Sudan. Now that doesn't count what the government pays. Local races got their own money to raise. Sure gotta fix all the voting machines when they break. And once we elect them, we sure gotta pay them a salary, healthcare, some kind of per diem. And tried to add it up, but you know what, just made my head ache. Now that doesn't mean it's not worth it at all. They work real hard, they answer the call, but the system costs money more and more each day. To govern yourself is a pain in the butt. It takes time, takes money, and then you know what? In the end, you might not even get your way. Yeah, that's the cost of democracy. Them people sure aren't kidding when they say freedom isn't free. Makes you feel good, it probably should, and I probably would agree. But just so you know, there's a cost to democracy. Now it does cost a lot to keep a dictator. They tend to spend first and ask questions later, and it ain't much fun to live at the point of a knife. You know, money gets spent at the whim of the creep, and let's face it, police states ain't horribly cheap. And then there's this little thing called quality of life. Still, it probably costs more to make our own choices, cast our own votes, and use our own voices. It's a cost we're willing to pay for freedom and such. But let's not, in our patriotic haste, forget there's still lots of room for waste, and maybe it don't have to cost us quite as much. You know, there's one other wrinkle creeps into the story, a price we can pay for democracy's glory, costs we should add to the list we've more recently found. As much as it costs to run our own place, keep our democracy going apace, we can spend a whole heck of a lot more trying to spread it around. And that's the cost of democracy. Them people sure ain't kidding when they say freedom isn't free. It makes you feel good, it probably should, and I probably would agree. Yeah, just so you know, there's a cost to democracy. One more time. Yeah, just so you know, there's a cost to democracy. Thank you, everybody. That would be the smarts behind me, Jimmy, Joe, and Mo backing me up. Mo on a washboard. I'm Jeff Horwich. Thanks for joining us on In the Loop. Now, here's where our show is going to take a turn for the personal. Because this idea of democracy, it's not just for governments. You can find it, for example, in the workplace. Co-ops and collectives try to take this utopian idea and make it turn a profit. Sometimes, of course, utopias don't work out as planned. And for the past couple of years, Sandon Totten, who is one of our producers here on the show, has been finding this out.
Finding out in a bad kind of way, Jeff.
Now, this place you're going to tell us about, would you call this, what, a worker democracy?
Yeah, I would. It's a worker-run bookstore in Minneapolis. And I should point out that it's a radical bookstore, as you might have guessed. So you won't find a single copy of The Da Vinci Code. But if you're looking for Das Kapital, we've got you covered. Hmm.
Harry Potter?
Maybe.
Dr. Phil?
Dr. Seuss.
Okay. Now, I know that you're very, very busy with our show, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so why would you add more work to your already busy life?
Okay, well, this is going to sound a little corny, but I believe in the dream. I believe in the idea that you let people make their own decisions, you let them be heard in a fair and open place, and they'll make the best choices. And this bookstore is one place where I can see that dream in action.
Yeah, so, Sandon, are you living the dream?
Not exactly. I'd say it's more of a series of waking moments. You see, our bookstore is run completely by volunteers. There's about 20 of us, and we meet every Friday night to hammer out all the decisions that go into making a business run. We use a process called consensus. It was developed by Quakers, and consensus is dry, bland, tedious, boring, kind of like their oats. The idea, though, is that no decision is made until everyone's had their say, so it's an incredibly democratic process. but it can also make a discussion on whether or not to buy recycled toilet paper last for 2 hours. But things get done. Decisions are made. Business happens. We've never made a lot of money, but the bookstores always managed to stay open. But then one day, money started going missing. At first, we thought it was just a fluke. I mean, who would steal from a collective? That's just bad karma. But then it happened again, and again, and again, until eventually, we couldn't deny it. We had a thief. So our collective sprang into action. We changed our locks, we bolted our windows, we hid our money in a different spot every night. But no matter where we hid it, the thief kept finding it. And our locks hadn't been jimmied or anything. That's when it hit us. This was an inside job. From that point on, our meetings were useless. Any decisions we made about security were heard by the thief. We were helpless. So we formed a secret police. Now, it wasn't everybody. It was just me and three other longtime volunteers. We started meeting outside the collective without telling our comrades. Now, I know that doesn't sound like a very democratic idea. And in fact, I'm pretty sure that if the others knew about it, they would have flipped. But they didn't know. And what choice did we have? I mean, it felt dirty, but a few more weeks of this, and the bookstore would have closed. Now, we weren't some elite force like the Stasi or anything. In fact, our collective crime-fighting knowledge probably amounted to a handful of Nancy Drew and Encyclopedia Brown books we read as kids. But as paranoid radicals, we knew a thing or two about invasions of personal privacy. First off, we got a camera. No one would escape our ever-watchful eye now. Except before we got a chance to actually set up the camera and get it to work, the thief stole that too. I had a plan to sprinkle flour along the floor outside the safe and then I'd catch all the footprints and then match them against the various volunteers. But then I realized that this was a collective and everybody either wears Birkenstocks or Doc Martens. So that idea, completely garbage. Eventually, our plan boiled down to a good old-fashioned stakeout. We took turns watching the store overnight from a car parked across the street. And it was awful. I kept falling asleep and waking up with my face stuck to the window. And at that point, the car was so fogged up from my breathing that I couldn't even see the store anyway. And this went on for weeks. But then one day, we actually caught the guy. And just like that, boom, democracy was back on. Now, we have all sorts of bylaws for dealing with anyone who breaks the rules of the store. And we followed them to the T. We even gave the guy a chance to defend himself at our next meeting. But it was too late. At that point, the damage was done. To catch this guy, we'd crossed the line. You could see it on the faces of our comrades. They knew we'd been spying on them. When we went back to our Friday night meeting, things felt, I don't know, just weird. Like it was all some sort of game with made-up rules. Sure, we were expected to stick with them, but what did it matter? I, for one, had broken them, and now the rules to this whole utopian democracy thing just seemed kind of hollow and arbitrary. The truth is, it isn't easy to keep a democracy running. And in my heart, I'd like to think we'd do a better job the second time around. But I can't imagine what else we could have done. We had to save the store. Still, when you go outside the system you love to keep it alive, you never really get back the democracy you started with.
That's Sandon Totten, everybody. Now, Sandon's bookstore was one of those times when a crisis means we push aside our democratic ideals to bring some order back to the community. Think of it like imposing martial law, maybe. But what would happen if democracy could be used to take a troubled institution, a failed state, if you will, and actually make it right again? To think about that, let's shift from a business to a family. Larissa Anderson is another producer of ours. Hi, Larissa.
Hi, Jeff.
Now, you've been visiting with a family that's using what you might call a democratic process to try and deal with a crisis that they're having. Tell us more.
Yeah, well, first I should say the family still has a pending court case and asked us not to use their names. So our story starts with Grandpa. He was living in Texas when he got a phone call saying his three grandchildren were in foster care. His daughter-in-law and son were half the country away. They were dealing with drug abuse and close to losing their rights as parents. Grandpa felt powerless.
what's going to happen with these children. Their life is really at stake.
So he and Grandma moved to Minnesota to help get the children back with the family. But that process was a little more difficult than they thought it would be. In fact, Grandpa's son says the county was trying to push their own agenda.
You got some social workers that'll work with the parents and keep on working with you. And then you got some that they call the terminator. And them the ones that like to just terminate parental rights. And that's so what we got. We got a terminator.
And if the parents did lose their rights, Grandpa and Grandma thought the children should be with them. But one of the obstacles Grandpa immediately came up against was Child Protection Services. He just didn't feel like he was getting through to them.
We better understand the needs of our grandchildren. And what was happening was, even though we was communicating that, the agency was apparently either didn't hear it or didn't believe it. It wasn't until family group decision-making came into play that things started working out.
Family group decision-making is a kind of child welfare that's democratically driven. Instead of the courts making the decisions, the family gets together to discuss and decide for themselves what's best for their children. And if they come up with a plan that satisfies the county's concerns, the county then recommends that plan to the court. As part of this process, Grandpa's family met up with a group of social workers and a facilitator in a room completely outside of the court system. A neutral location.
You got windows. It was, you know, nice sunlight. We had pizza. They ordered us food. And it's a nice setting for decision making.
To start the meeting, the social workers went over how the family got in the crisis in the first place. And then they talked about what the family had to address in their plan to ensure the children's safety.
Then all of those support services, all of the agencies, workers leave the room. And then there's just the family.
That's Grandpa, Grandma, their son, and their daughter-in-law. The son's brother and sister couldn't be there in person, but they joined the discussion by phone from their homes in Chicago. Before even starting their conversation, they all agreed on some ground rules.
You have to be open, and you have to be honest at this meeting. So your life is an open book now, and the people that is in that book is going to be all of the characters sitting there at the table.
The very structure of the meeting gave them an equal voice and encouraged them to listen to one another. It was empowering and humbling at the same time. Grandma says for the son, the hard part about having a voice was being so honest in front of the whole family.
Because now his brother and sister have more of an insight on what's going on with him and his wife. And it was kind of an embarrassment for him.
Yeah, it was embarrassing because there was a lot of things brought up that I feel kind of ashamed about.
But by us all being there and able to participate, it took the darkness into light.
In other words, the democratic process allowed her son and daughter-in-law to be more transparent.
At that meeting, they were more open. They were more communicative about what was going on with them. And they wasn't like that before this family group decision meeting.
I think what she's saying is because we kind of isolate ourselves a little bit, you know, when I was using drugs, I kind of isolated myself.
The daughter-in-law and the rest of the family sorted through their options and talked about the best way to reunite the parents with the children. If that didn't work, then Grandpa and Grandma would adopt the kids. They even came up with a contingency plan. So if something happened to the grandparents, the siblings in Chicago would then be the primary caregivers. For 5 hours, they talked. And when they were done, they finally had a plan.
And there was a sigh, and then we started, you know, it was a little light joking, and, you know, because a decision had been made. So we laughed and joked and finished eating the pizza that was at the table.
Then they called back the social workers to present their plan. Grandpa says the legal system can be unforgiving and insensitive. But for them, family group decision-making was a good form of checks and balances.
It even protects against that terminating child protection worker. You know, it keeps them from overexerting their authority because the family now has a voice.
So, Larissa, why is it fair, do you think, to call what this family went through, you know, a democratic process or democracy?
Well, their experience really highlights some of the core values of democracy, like equality and compromise and cooperation. I mean, here's a family that was treated by the child welfare system basically as a sovereign nation. They all shared the decision-making power. They all had a voice.
Would you say dealing with their crisis that way worked for them in the end?
Yeah, I would. Grandpa said that the experience was very empowering and they all came out of the process a more united family.
So what's the outcome of all of this for him?
Well, the court date's still a few weeks away and chances are the parents will lose their rights. If that happens, Grandpa's waiting to see if the judge will accept the plan he and his family created together.
So whether the powers that be will let democracy in this case run its course. Thank you very much, Larissa. Larissa Anderson. Now, we heard a little while ago about this this bookstore, an example of sort of suspending democracy in a crisis. That story about the family there was about turning to the democratic process to set things right again. What about if you choose of your own free will to live without democracy? There are people around the world who will make that argument, and closer to home, something like membership in a cult might certainly qualify. Sitting next to me now up on stage are Rose and Andrea Fricke. You are half-sisters, right?
Yeah, we don't think of ourselves as half-sisters, so.
Full-sisters.
Yeah.
Okay. You guys are both former members of a religious group here in St. Paul, something called the Christ's Household of Faith. It has about 500 members. It's got a school, right, a fleet of communal cars, owns several businesses. It's Christian-based, and there's one sort of prophet guy who very clearly is in charge of everybody. Is that a fair description?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. So, Rose, you're a former member, but you spent most of your life in this group. As a member of the group, what do you have to give over?
Well, for me, I was born into it, so I didn't realize what I was giving over. But as I grew older, I realized that I was giving up basically my free will. Like, the biggest example is when you graduate from high school, you're kind of evaluated by the leaders of the church, and then you are assigned a job. And if you don't like it, tough. You're stuck in that job. You're assigned where you live. You're assigned if another person or family would live with you. You're assigned a car. Even in high school, I wasn't allowed to choose any classes. So when I got to college, I was like, what? I get to choose classes? What is this? It was really weird.
What happens to the money that you make in your job, Andrea?
All of the jobs that you're put into are businesses that are owned by the group. And so the business makes money. It's put into a collective pot. You don't make an individual
salary. But you are given an allotment every 2 weeks. Whether you're a baby or whether you're the president of a company, you're given the same amount of money every 2 weeks.
In both of your cases, it was your parents who sort of made this decision for you.
That's right.
And I think for most of us, we have to wonder why anybody would do it. Why would you put yourself in this kind of, you know, emasculating situation? You can't control anything.
At the end of the 60s and early 70s, which is when Christ's Household of Faith was started, in general, in the U.S., there was kind of like, people were kind of looking for a purpose. It was the end of the hippie movement, or people were coming out of the military, like my dad, and he was kind of looking for a purpose, and he was not used to making choices for himself. So he, I think, found a lot of comfort in this, in the fact that somebody else can make the choices for you, and you still get to have a car and have a house and have a life, and you don't have to think as much about the specific choices.
Did you two ever have comfort in that? Did you find comfort in that?
Well, can I just say, you know, these altruistic words like love and community and the positive things about a community like the bookstore that he was talking about, and I think that these are valid reasons to start a group, you know. It was about the community, about I had 300 to 500 people who knew me and loved me.
You were taken care of.
Always taken care of, always felt
very secure.
Like we lived in a small town. We didn't have fears like some of the, like my children now have going to a public school, you know.
Yeah, now, for the two of you, what did you imagine was waiting outside the walls?
Our only window to the world was television.
Yeah. And I really thought that those people that I saw on TV were like the people next door to me and that they were happier than I was. But more to the topic of democracy, I had a real idealistic view of democracy when I was in CHOF. I kind of wanted to be able to make my own choices. That was so important to me. I felt so stripped of my individuality, and I just wanted to choose. Even if it was the wrong choice, I wanted to choose. So when I got out of CHOF, that kind of crumbled, that idea of democracy.
CHOF is the acronym for the church.
Sorry. Yeah.
Sure, that's fine.
it's nice that I get to make my own choices, but now I feel like nobody really cares. You know? Like, in CHOP, I could say it, and people would listen, and they'd say, oh, wow, that's wonderful, we love you, but we're not going to do that. But now, you know, it's just, I don't feel as cared for. People care about me as much.
Andrea, you left and then went back.
Right, right.
What happened to you in the real world?
Well, at 19, I was just so disillusioned by everything. I just ran away. So right away, got involved with a man very, very much older than me, authoritative, and realized, oh my gosh, I just entered another cult, you know? And then went to college, and I was like, this is a whole nother cult. The ideas that I thought, I kept them with me, and it doesn't work in this society because not everyone is looking out for your best interest.
Yeah.
You don't learn these things in our society because we were raised to be good in the society, not to be members of a capitalistic, democratic America.
We weren't taught
America.
To make choices. We weren't
exactly.
taught to be able. We weren't given that skill.
Now, there are plenty of international metaphors that jump out here, I think. Maybe you both have a kind of a special vantage on why somebody in another country, say China, might feel differently about it than, of course, it looks to us from the outside.
Yeah, I mean, like with us, I see democracy through my lens of coming from communistic society. I mean, that's the closest thing that I could relate CHOP to. I don't see it now as this big, beautiful, wonderful thing. I see that there are parts about the community that we came from that worked and that worked for that, and they were positive things in that community. If you chose to be in that community, but the problem is that we didn't choose to be there. So for my parents, they had that choice. They see the positive parts about CHOP and they can say, I like this. I don't so much like this about democracy. I'm going to go over here. And so I could see that in China, you know, people could say, I like the way I live. I'm sure there are people in China who may not like their government, but I'm sure there are plenty of people who do, who agree with it and say, this works for me, you know?
Well, Rose Fricke, Andrea Fricke, thank you very much for coming on in the loop and talking with us. Now, Rose and Andrea are actually members of what we call our Public Insight Network, which is a growing group of people who we reach out to as collaborators for our show. They help us inform the episodes that we put together, and so we were fortunate as we began looking for who we knew already to find some people who could pull from very personal experience and help us think a little bit about democracy tonight. If you're listening to the show now and you're not in our network, we'd love to have you on board. You can find that at minnesotapublicradio.org/intheloop. There's a Join the Network link over on the right-hand side of the page. Let's bring the house lights up here in the UBS Forum. Actually, I want to turn things over to our audience and see if we can get a few more examples and thoughts about democracy in our lives, when we use it, when we can do without. Now, we've heard some admittedly extreme examples so far in the show. The worker collective, a family about to fall apart, a religious cult in that last interview. I think our audience can help us bring this back down to earth a little bit. Let's go back for a moment to the family. Here's a quick moment from another person who we know. This is Lucy.
We have small children and we want to raise them to be good citizens, and we teach them about democracy by putting them in a complete and utter dictatorship. We are in charge. And I have actually heard myself say when my little guy was 2 years old, I will not negotiate with terrorists because they'll terrorize you. But how am I teaching them to work in the society where it's like my way or the highway?
So it's not so easy to promote democracy as an ideal throughout our lives. Anybody else, whether it's a family example, a workplace example, where has democracy been tried? Where have you tried it? Yes.
Hi, I'm Tanya. I'm from Excelsior. And I work in a school that runs by consensus. It's a nonprofit school. And the thing that I really like about it is I think that the essence of democracy is not that freedom is important, but that with freedom comes responsibility. And when you operate under consensus, everyone is forced to take responsibility for the decisions that they make. And part of that is because you also understand the decisions that were made.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Another one over here. Great.
Hi, I'm Nancy. I'm from St. Paul. I was a member of the student government at my college, and we had a student organization leader come in, and he ran his group by consensus, but we were having our non-consensus meeting, and there was direct tension of us making decisions. He's like, no, I don't agree with that. We're like, well, we don't really care what you have to say because A, you're not part of our board, and B, this isn't consensus, it's purely majority. So we could see the conflict between his system, which took a lot longer, and our system, which was strictly like three quarters vote. So it was a very much like efficiency versus fairness. And it was very apparent in this one situation. And I think that's why like our country, for example, isn't consensus-based, because it's just frankly not efficient.
Thanks for jumping in. Let's just talk about this word for a minute. What's the state of the word democracy? Is it in good shape? Yes, please, sir. Your name and where you're from.
Clayton. I think democracy is going through a synthesis. I don't think that it's the same word as it was penned and as it's defined. I think democracy, once it comes out and it interfaces with society, it takes on a whole nother meaning.
Clayton, where are you from?
St. Paul.
Thank you. Anybody else want to jump in there? Yes, please.
Hi, I'm Anthony from St. Paul. And I definitely agree with that gentleman over there. The word is changing, and I think it's ironic to say, but the word democracy has become a very politically charged word, and that the meaning has become an end as opposed to a means to an end. So democracy is this result now instead of the process that we get to a good society. And I think you can see that at all levels of politics right now, especially at the top.
Thanks. Sure.
Well, I found that...
Give us your name. Good.
Yeah. My name is Gabe. I live in Minneapolis. And I find that democracy allows organizations to stay together through tough times in ways that autocratic rule cannot. When people don't have a voice in a society, they tend to leave or try to leave. And it's even apparent at a small scale. I'm playing with a trio right now, and one of the members of the trio is sort of trying to take it over and run it. And the other two of us were just going to leave, and then we wouldn't have had a trio if we didn't have democracy. So that's one good thing about democracy.
Seems like a nice note to turn to our house band, the Smarts. And as usual, we ask them to apply themselves to our topic tonight. And I admit, this week was up there on the difficulty scale, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Joe, our bass player, how'd you guys come out on this?
Well, we set out in our usual fashion to write a song about the week's theme. This time it was democracy. And I wanted to write something about our country's recent efforts to, let's say, export democracy to the rest of the world. So as usual, every member of the band brought something to the table. Jim came up with his catchy melody and chord changes, and Mo came up with a really neat feel to go behind that. And then, as usual, I wrote my clever, witty lyrics like I normally do. So when we put those all together, they sounded something like this.
Democracy, democracy, a mighty Western panacea. If it don't kill you, it could free ya. Sorry if you don't agree.
And we were all pretty happy with that. We could have probably left it right there. Mo pointed out that really, if we're going to do a song about democracy, we should compose it democratically. So, Mo, you actually think that we should put every element of this song up for a vote?
Yes, that's what I think.
All right, let's start with the drum part. I think it gets in the way, actually, of the lyrics and of Jim's piano part, and I think you should simplify it. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Motion carried.
Fine. You want a simpler drum part? Check this out.
Yeah, that'll work. That's good. Let's try it. 2, 3, 4. Democracy, democracy. You know what? Stop. The piano part's not working.
I think it works
because
fine.
Because it's too complicated to go with the drum part. Now.
I think we ought to put this up to a vote.
Yeah, I think we should. And you know what? The chord changes are cool, but they get in the way of the lyrics. And can we simplify the melody and the chord changes? All in favor?
Aye. Motion carried.
Motion carried.
I'll give you something.
Yeah, that'll work. That's great.
Perfect.
That's good. Okay, let's try it, guys.
1, 2, 3. Mm.
Democracy, democracy, democracy.
Whoa. You know, Joe, I got a question about these lyrics. You know, we really haven't had the best luck instituting democracy around the world, and your lyrics really don't seem to...
That's the point of the lyrics of the song, is that it isn't a good idea. They're supposed to be ironic. I'm not... advocating exporting democracy.
Joe, I did not get that at all.
Are you kidding?
I took them right at face value.
Yeah, what's a panacea?
No.
Hold on. Jim, I've got an idea. Joe, Jim was working on some lyrics.
Great.
And I would like you to take a look at these and see what you think. Here you go.
Okay, these are stupid. These are bad. I can't sing these.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Motion carried, Joe.
All right, let's try them. You might think democracy, it should be buena. When we brought it to you, you kinda go insane. Now things are worse than with Saddam Hussein. Thanks, Dick Cheney.
The Smarts, everybody. Learn a little more about them at thesmartsband.com. You're listening to In the Loop. I'm Jeff Horwich. As we get near the end of the show here, let's pull back into Big D democracy. The big question we're ultimately dealing with tonight is whether being democratic is a fundamental part of being human. It's hard to tell as you look around the world. Are people yearning for democracy? Or is actual democracy not so important as long as you have things like economic security and safety? And maybe not everyone thinks about democracy just like Americans do. Iraq is the big example, of course, right at the moment. Right now, it's such a mess over there, it's hard to even talk about a philosophical thing like democracy. But democracy is front and center in a country like Liberia. In 2005, Liberia held what were the most open, fair, and peaceful elections in the country's 187-year history. Today, as we're taping this show, as a matter of fact, Liberia's president was actually in Washington meeting with President Bush. No doubt they're comparing notes on how to run an awesome democracy. Ahmed Sirleaf grew up in Liberia. He's with me now. He works for Minnesota Advocates for Human Rights and also happens to be in our listener network. And that's how we came to know him. Ahmed, thank you for being here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, we'll just point out, you've got the same last name as Liberia's president, but you are very distantly related, right?
Yes, it's a distant relationship. So don't come to me. I can't influence her to do anything for you.
Ahmed, what's going on in your country right now? Fill us in. I mean, is this basically just applying American-style democracy to Liberia?
In a way, yes, because as you mentioned, they had an election, free and fair election, and it's more or less like the American-style democracy.
What do you think about that? Does it work? Just slap American democracy in there?
I don't necessarily think so, because it hasn't worked in the past. There have been several attempts, and I think that there should be some type of combination of what's practical in the context, in the Liberian context or in the African context, as well as what's possible from the American perspective.
So what are some examples? I mean, have you ever just sort of looked at what's going on in your country or in West Africa in general, because you've been back recently, and just seen stuff that says, wait a minute, this isn't quite clicking?
I was in Ghana. I just got back 5 days ago, and for example, I see Ghanaians in Accra, for instance, dressed up in three-piece suits, you know, in hot 100-degree weather, and I just don't think it makes sense.
Why is that?
Because that was what was fair to them, that this is a way to show, to portray that you're sophisticated, you're educated, you are a civilized person, you have to be dressed in a certain way. My thinking is if people were made to think and believe that it's normal, it's okay to dress in your traditional Ghanaian outfit and go to your office or go to your working place, it's civilized, it's democratic, in my view.
So what do you think? In Ghana, in Liberia, where you're from,
right,
what kind of things do you imagine need to happen to, I don't know, to customize democracy for your people?
What comes to mind is, for instance, the way powers dispense, the way government appointments are made in Liberia. Here in the United States, for instance, you're looking for efficiency, you're looking for someone who is competent, who is committed, who can do the job, right? So
sure,
that is a democratic practice. Whereas in Liberia, in my view, because the way the country is set up based on ethnic division, regional divisions. People have loyalty to the tribe, to the ethnic group, to the region, the village where they come from. I think if you totally depend on the American ideas of democracy and just dispense power without considering the way traditional people view powers and authority, the expectations that comes with age, for instance, respect for elders.
Well, tell me about that. How important is that in Liberia?
Well, it's important because people believe that they ought to speak and express themselves through their leaders. If you are an elderly person, you are respected in a certain way. If you're a younger person, there are expectations that you respect the elders. Say, if I was sitting in a chair and an elderly man entered the room, I'm expected to get up and give them the seat.
But that goes to some extent for politics, too, you're saying, right?
Exactly.
Deference to elders. Yeah. So if you take something like that, when deference to people who are older than you is so important in society,
right,
you have sort of the traditional clan structure you were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Can you actually put democracy on top of that and still have it be democracy?
Yes, because that's what the people believe in. That's the way they express themselves. That's what they regard as an organized, harmonious society. You ought to think of it as a democratic process. This is an invaluable custom and tradition. These are positive aspects of the Liberian culture, of the African culture, that ought to be added to whatever we bring from the West. I can't just go, because I'm from America, and expect everyone to behave the way I do.
And what you're talking about, I mean, it still adheres to that original definition of democracy, right? Government by the people. I guess it's only through the years and what Americans think of as being democracy, we kind of attach all kinds of strings to that, but they don't necessarily exist in a pure form.
They don't. That's what everyone spoke about, that we heard tonight, that democracy doesn't necessarily mean just people should have the free will to express themselves. That's good, but there are other aspects that need to be considered. Respect for other people's culture, respect for other people's customs. So just impose something that was meant for Europe or was meant for the United States to Africa that has different cultural composition and cultural beliefs.
It's worth pointing out, Liberia's president is a woman.
Yes, she is.
So in some cases, there's a more evolved democracy there than
we're very proud of that.
The one that it's based upon. Ahmed Sirleaf, thank you very much.
No problem. It's a pleasure.
For joining us.
Thank you for having me.
This is In the Loop. I'm Jeff Horwich. We titled this episode, Democracy, Is It In You? If the democratic impulse is really inside us, I figure we can find it in kids. Literally, democracy in its unadulterated form, right? For a brief misguided moment, I thought maybe that would show up in this new Kid Nation TV show.
40 kids with no parents, no teachers anywhere.
Wow.
And their leaders? They're kids too.
No.
It's the first ever Kid Nation.
Now, if democracy somehow involved being divided into teams and competing for bars of gold, we'd be on to something here. Now, that metaphor is kind of fun up to a point, truth be told, but democracy is rather serious. It's not a game show. We found our example of kids and democracy quite a bit closer to home, a Montessori school in Minneapolis. Now, the first thing you notice about a Montessori classroom is that kids are amazingly self-sufficient. They go quietly back and forth from math problems to group projects, and then you see there's a bunch of them that have headed off to clean up the kitchen. Three boys, while I was sitting in this one classroom, 8 or 9 years old, are working out a dispute over what picture they should put on a card.
I told him to switch it, and he said, yeah.
You guys didn't need the teacher's help with that?
No.
Is that like lots of things? You kind of work it out without the teacher?
Yeah, sometimes.
The Montessori thing started in fascist Italy, then got kicked out of fascist Italy. The basic concept is that kids are born with the ability and desire to govern their own actions. It follows that the human race is better off if schools respect and nurture this from day one rather than just dispensing orders, like Mussolini. It's a worldwide educational system built on the leap of faith that democracy is in us all. Paulette Zoe is the principal of Lake Country Montessori.
This is something inherent in our species, and you can never know everything about it, but you have to trust that if you create the environment for this to unfold, it will unfold in the way that it should.
Now, even though it may be in us, apparently you can't just impose childhood democracy if the conditions aren't right. One thing crucial to a functioning democracy here is the grace and courtesy training that all Montessori kids get from the age of 3. Montessori students also share the same class with the same kids for 3 years at a time to develop their commitment to that small community. By the time they're older, students are pretty much directing their own studies and they're governing their own affairs within the classroom. I asked some 13-year-olds who are just about to graduate from the school if they thought this would work in other schools.
If we take this system and put it into some other public school, that would be terrible.
What would happen?
It'd be chaos. I mean, there might be a chance we could do it little pieces at a time, you know, to give some freedoms. If you just replace it, they're just going to be like, I have no clue what to do.
I just think it needs a lot of time to build up and for people to adjust to it.
I don't think I need to connect the dots here. Here's something else I found a little baffling about these kids. As much as they love their way of doing things, as much as the whole Montessori concept is built on the fact that kids are better off with this democratic kind of education, I could not get them to admit that they think their system is better.
It's just another way of approaching education.
It's a different system.
I would never really know. I've never been to a public school.
Imagine that. Now, don't get me wrong. Americans are right to be proud of their democracy. I am. I admit it. And you know, we do okay. We're the 17th best democracy in the world, according to The Economist magazine. As much as we love this idea, we just have to keep things in perspective, like those Montessori kids. Our democracy's great. Is it flawless? No way. And it will never look the same to other people as it does to us. With that thought, I'm going to strap on this Chinese-made toy accordion for one last ode to our theme tonight. D is for democracy, where everyone helps out. And G is for the Greeks who said,
let's see what that's about.
In Athens, everyone could vote, their decision carried the day. Except for slaves and women, who don't matter anyway. All right, here we go. You know, the founding fathers launched a government to make us proud. As long as you had land and were otherwise endowed. Indians were hunted, you know, blacks were slaves down south. But that's all in the past, right? Now we've got things straightened out. You know, today it's way much better. We've worked out all the kinks. It's free and fair and we don't care what anybody thinks. I challenge you to find a single thing that we do wrong. You know, everybody's happy and we all get along. Ain't that true? That's the Smarts behind me, by the way. More about them at thesmartsband.com. That's our show for tonight. You can join the network of listeners who help us build the show, subscribe to the podcast, check out the Loophole blog, get tickets to future tapings, all that stuff at minnesotapublicradio.org/in the loop. In the Loop is produced by Julie Seipel, Sandon Totten, and Larissa Anderson. Our interns are Bradley Campbell and Anton Bryant. Thanks to Molly Bloom, Melody Yang, and Preston Wright from Public Insight Journalism. We get multimedia help from Christina Schmidt. Our photographer is Jeremy Pavlik. Live assistance tonight from Ambar Espinoza. Our technical director is Josh Kubasta, with engineer Maury Jensen and live producer Alan Freckman. Jim Gates is our editor. Our senior producer is Mark Brule. Production of In the Loop is supervised by Leif Bishop. Our executive producer is Michael Scholar. Thanks to all of our guests tonight. Of course, our audience who joined us here at Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Jeff Horwich. See you next time in the Loop. Hello, everybody. This is Jeff again. Hope you enjoyed this second new episode of our fall season. Coming up Wednesday night, it's time for another one of our story slams. Just in time for Halloween, the theme is disguise. Anyone and everyone can sign up that night to give us their best story. We'll pull names from a hat until we're out of time. This time we're at the very cool Suburban World Theater at Hennepin and Lake in Minneapolis. Eat and drink while you watch. More info on the Story Slam and other shows we've got in the pipeline at minnesotapublicradio.org/in the loop.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Bose, offering Bose in-ear headphones designed for comfort and quality sound and featuring soft silicone tips in three sizes at bose.com/radio.